If there was ever one, there could be two. You and you and you. A blue sky could be bluer, a whiter shade of white. But while you...
Good morning. We're hearing some music from the Indigo Girls this morning. One of the artists performing at the Fresh Grass Festival at Mass Mocha on the 14th through the 16th will be playing their music. Not just the Indigo Girls, but music from Fresh Grass throughout the morning this morning. And also, we're going to have the folks from Mass Mocha come in and tell us about that event coming up. Of course, we welcome your letters on this September 11th. panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the panel to you, and we'll get started right away. Joe Bonilla is with us, a communications consultant and our dear friend. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Joe. How are you?
Wonderful. Very nice to have you here.
As always.
J.P. Miller joins us. He is the Empire Report, the man behind that. It's not a publication. It's a, what is it?
Just a website.
A website.
Some, news
not
links.
Just a website.
Yes.
It's much more than just a website.
Good to be here, Joe.
More than a series of tubes. There
yeah,
you go.
All right. Yes. Yeah, more than a series of tubes. Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How's everything all right?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, good. And Mike Spain is here. Mike Spain joins us every Tuesday, and he has for years and years and years and years. Even before we had a panel, Mike would be on, and we would do, at that point, headlines of the day. And it's 17 years since September 11th, 2001. And 17 years ago, 9/11 was on a Tuesday, and Mike was on our show. And at that time, it was Susan Arbetter and myself, and we were hosting, and Mike was our guest. And through a series of unfortunate events that I won't bore you with, NPR had issues.
Was that the antenna on top of the World Trade
Tower? Well, that
Tower.
Was one of the issues, right. And so they had some trouble. And yeah. So consequently, we could not go to the network for this breaking story until about 10:30 almost. So that was an hour and a half that we were left kind of just reading copy and watching television and trying to convey to people. But we had with us Mike Spain, who was our guiding star in all of that and helping who was helping compile very interesting facts as the time went on.
Right. We were just clutching at whatever was could be relevant, trying to talk about the World Trade Towers, talking about history of skyscrapers and problems, and looking for it. And then when the second tower was hit, you said this is without question a terrorist attack. And then it wasn't long after that we began to separately go through our own resources to try to tell the story. And it was just unbelievable. Unbelievable. We couldn't have imagined how horrific that morning was.
So when people say, those are the times in your life where you remember where you were, I certainly remember where I was, but thank God Mike Spain was with me.
There you go.
Alan, you were in Italy.
I was given by our wonderful Board of Trustees, I was given a furlough to go and sabbatical to go and to go to Italy with Roselle, and we got there and 4 days later, whatever, we were coming back from we were on a ferry, and a German tourist next to me took out his cell phone and excitedly started to point. Oh, we were coming back from Capri. Started to point at the news at his phone, and that's when I learned. And of course, we all called our kids, and he let us use the thing to make sure that they were all right, because we didn't remember, folks. We didn't know if we were at war at that point of the game.
No, we didn't know what was going on.
And nobody had it. I knew I had to come back to WAMC and to my job. And Roselle has never quite forgiven me for that. But we did learn about that. And I want everybody to know one thing. There wasn't the television around the world that wasn't tuned into that, watching those planes crash into the tower again and again and again. And people were so nice. We were at the Colosseum. They closed down the Colosseum for several minutes to do homage to their American friends. And it was quite a thing. It was a worldwide event, all right.
Sure was.
Well, I mean, I was in high school at the time. I was in physics class.
Oh, yeah.
Pick a finger.
We didn't even hear about the World Trade Center first. We heard the Pentagon first. Another teacher from, I went to Albany High, and so another teacher from another part of the building ran into our room, said that the Pentagon got hit. We turned the television on, and we saw the World Trade Center. Now, my dad was actually working in Lower Manhattan, and he was actually coming out of the Battery Tunnel when it happened. Didn't find out for a couple of days if he was all right or not. And so it's been interesting. And also, my great-grandfather worked on the building, worked in the Trade Center as well. So it's had an interesting impact on my life in that way. Yeah.
Remarkable.
I was a junior in college in my dorm room, not going to class, and watched television all day and many days thereafter. And in recent years, living in New York City, went to both the 9/11 Memorial and the museum. And anybody that hasn't gone to the memorial and the museum, it is well worth the trip. They certainly tell the story and bring you back to that day that we all remember.
It is it's quite stunning, the work that they've done there. I know it's taken a long time, and my God, 17 years, and they just, you know, they just opened the subway station.
Right, this weekend. Yeah, I guess you had mentioned that as a possibility to talk about it. I think it's remarkable how Lower Manhattan has come back. I mean, it is more populated than it was. They say 30% more people. Families live in Lower Manhattan now. It's vibrant. It's full of people. It's almost like inspirational the way people went back and embraced that part of the city and brought it back to life because it was so dark right afterwards, and, you know, metaphorically and physically. I mean, it was just a sad tragedy that has been sort of compensated for by the life that's in that part of the city right now.
But, you know, certainly with the Cortlandt Street station reopening now, I mean, it's the, you know, the latest station to open up since, obviously, the 2nd Avenue subway opened up about, you know, a year and a half ago. It's remarkable to finally see that open, but it, you know, you would think, you know, not to obviously talk about this in this way, but 17 years to reopen a subway station. You think maybe it could have been done a little bit earlier than that.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess they had some problems. They had to figure out where it was going to come up onto the street because they didn't know where buildings were going to go. But it's almost a commentary about how difficult it is to make progress improving the subway system.
Right. Well, and also yes, but I mean, think of all of the trouble they had even with the tower, the World Trade. What's it called now?
Freedom Tower.
I mean, just in building the museum, opening. I mean, the museum didn't even make it for the 10th anniversary. So, I mean, there was a lot of politics involved in that. Obviously, a lot of you know, it's a mass grave. So there's a lot of issues there. So all those things take a lot of time. But
and coming out of those subways now, they are so deep in the ground. You have to go up. It feels like 3 or 4 or 5 stories out of the ground to get out of the subway.
God for the escalators.
Yes.
Which is also the case. Well, even in the memorial, in the museum, there's the wall, right? They have the
retaining wall,
that holds back the
seawater, basically
from the Hudson, that is what was the base of the World Trade Center. It's really quite amazing when you look at it and see that. And realize just the devastation of what happened on that day.
There's actually a permanent exhibit over at the New York State Museum here in Albany on Madison Avenue in the State Education Building. And they're going to have a kind of a gallery tour today at 12:30 at it. But it's the exhibit that World Trade Center Rescue, Recovery, and Response. And it's a tribute to the responders to the World Trade Center. There's even a couple of emergency vehicles, a fire engine that were taken right from the scene and are in the shape that they were after they were destroyed. And it's just a remarkable local view of what happened and the heroics that happened from public employees, firefighters, and emergency workers, and police, of course. Amazing.
Mark Schamming of the museum did an amazing job. He was one of the first people down there at the landfill, bringing all when the material was coming
artifacts,
in and going,
right.
bringing those artifacts through and cataloging them and working on them, obviously for the purposes of the state, but also as an ongoing investigation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So we will talk about other stuff this morning. And
you know, Joe, just one thing.
Yeah, sure.
It's so important that we remember, you know, not only this event, but the people who died. And not only the people who died, but then the people who died later, you know, doing all of the work and ingested fumes we had no idea about. You know, I was struck by the remark about how many people are living down there now and how many more people are there. And you think of Tokyo. You think of Hiroshima and, you know, how resilient people are.
Right.
But it's so important to remember who isn't here anymore.
But also those who were affected by those who passed away.
Sure.
And you know, certainly that long-term impact.
Children,
spouses,
grandchildren.
Exactly.
You also think of that the kids that are born around that time, that shortly thereafter, we have been at war ever since.
That's right. We have pretty much been at war. It's been kind of in the background. It doesn't affect everybody directly. If you don't have family there, it's very easy for some Americans to forget that we remain at war in Afghanistan. And we have the blazing situation in the Middle East, all the result of the Iraq War, really. And that was sort of the result of 9/11 in an odd kind of way, although it wasn't directly connected.
Those parallels were made, even though they weren't entirely accurate. But
yes, I remember the White House put out a statement finally saying, yes, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, but we're going to attack him anyway.
Yeah. And you will remember the governor getting after Pataki, who he claimed, this governor, our present governor, is saying he did nothing but hold Giuliani's coat. You remember that whole thing?
That was a remarkable comment. It was during the primary when Andrew Cuomo challenged Carl McCall. Was it 2002?
Two.
Yeah. Okay, good. And he was trying to get the Democratic nomination to run for governor. He lost that primary, but in that he was criticizing.
He was in high school then.
Didn't right. he brought,
yeah.
Didn't you remember?
But he knows, of course.
By the way, didn't he
I'm impressed, Joe.
Did he actually lose the primary or did he drop out first?
His name was still on the ballot, but he formally dropped out.
He got so roundly condemned, including by me. And let me tell you that my relationship with Mario sort of soured after that.
Well, now here he is in another primary in 2 days, Governor Andrew Cuomo, and the outcome, according to the polls today, you know, will be quite different.
41% lead in the polls. There was an NPR story this morning about, you know, of course, the Cynthia Nixon campaign is very much holding on to the possibility that
The polls are wrong,
as they have been in other key
races across
the country, especially when it comes to progressive candidates like Cynthia Nixon. So
we saw it in Boston, we saw it in Queens, and saw it in Florida, I guess, so we could see it in New York.
Yeah. And then you take a look at some of the stupid stuff. I mean, in the green room, we were having a discussion. We also had it on the air yesterday here, Joe, and that is. Why would Cuomo, who is a micromanager, allow his people to send that scurrilous letter about Cynthia Nixon being anti-Semitic out, you know, when he's got a 40-point lead in the polls?
Well, it's one of those things where you hope that you hire the right people that actually will do the right thing at the end of the campaign. But the other thing going back to the polls, though, is if you have a poll like that where you're up by 30 to 40 points, it's only going to drive down the turnout by super prime Democrats, Democrats who are going to come out every single time. So we've seen in time where you had folks up by these large margins, that margin will be cut in half by the time you get to primary day, if not by more.
Right. And although he might not have been at risk of losing the primary, being, losing some of the votes, you know, having his challenger do much better than anticipated will be
Detriment to running for president of the United States. We're hearing from a lot of people that he's not going to do it. His name is never on the list when they present the names. Gillibrand's is. They used to say, the worst place to be is between Chuck Schumer and a microphone. I think the worst place to be was between Andrew Cuomo and the presidency. You better watch out. If you're following along,
yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, you look at 4 years ago. with Teach, I mean, Teach got 35% of the vote.
She did.
And she was a total unknown, similar to also for the lieutenant governor's race. You had Tim Wu at the time.
Now, you also look at the teach-out numbers of the people who came out, and it was, she won Albany, right? And all the cities, yeah. With the exception, of course, of New York City. Hmm.
That's a big, of course.
But as somebody said, she won where anybody knew him.
Even this last poll says people are more or less not voting for her; they're voting against him.
Well, and I can tell you one person that doesn't think he's up by 41 points is Andrew Cuomo. He has spent $15 million, which is half of his war chest that he's been assembling over 4 or 5 years to defeat Ms. Nixon. He is taking this extremely seriously. This will be a very close race on Thursday. And I also think a lot of people say she doesn't have a chance of winning. I think she has a reasonable chance of winning. I'm not saying she's going to win, but she has a 20 to 30% chance of winning on Thursday.
And then in 10 seconds before we go to break, and then say he does win, and then you got Molinaro.
Yeah.
That's what they want you to think, certainly, the people who don't want Molinaro.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about this and other things. We welcome your letters, panel at WMC.org.
Baseline tears on a window pane. The bellways jammed in the driving rain. I can't tell the dog from the pain, 'cause I'm not there anymore. Say the word and I'll grab my keys. I'll start the car that's shaking me. We used to glow like the stars in the trees, but I'm not there anymore.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Again, playing music from Fresh Grass of bands and musicians who will be at the Fresh Grass Festival at Massmocha this coming weekend. That, of course, certainly a group that's on Mike Spain's playlist, Trampled by Turtles.
It's a great group.
Trampled by Turtles.
Just the title or the name of that group alone makes you want to hear them.
Trampled by Turtles.
But you've played them here before. They're great.
Yeah, absolutely. WAMC.org/roundtable to see the full playlist and to find out where you can find your favorite Trampled by Turtles song. All right, let's move on to other stuff and talk about things that are making news. So I positively begged Judith Eng to be on today because we have this methane story, and I wanted her to come in and talk about it. We have a lot of really good, actually, climate change stories. Unfortunately, she was is on a plane right now going to Washington, so was unable to be with us. But the
fair weather friend.
Well, she'll be back. She'll be back Friday. And so anyway, in a victory for energy companies, the Trump administration plans to roll back rules covering methane leaks and the flaring or burning of the potent greenhouse gas. It was the third major step this year to reverse the United States' previous efforts to rein in global warming. That is part one of our conversation. Part two is the UN chief is telling the world leaders to break the paralysis on climate change, calling climate change the defining issue of our time. Antonio Guterres, is that correct, said that the time has come for our leaders to show they care about the people whose fate they hold in their hands. That also happened yesterday. Third point that I will throw at the panel is Hurricane Florence is threatening the Carolinas. 1 million people ordered to evacuate. Government officials in North and South Carolina taking few chances. exhorting residents and tourists in coastal areas to leave. Expected to make landfall Thursday night with winds up to 140 miles per hour. The storm could pummel the coast and cause major inland flooding. This is one of those storms that when you see, when you they're getting ready to tell you about the coverage, and then you see it on radar, you're like, oh, damn. It's a monster.
That's the right name.
Well, yeah, I had called early this morning to my business partner, who actually is in Greenville, South Carolina, and actually they were originally in Myrtle Beach, and so a ton of their friends in Myrtle Beach are trying to basically get shelter inland. But nonetheless, you're starting to see these superstorms come up. We just saw this, you know, hit South Florida. But nonetheless, this is borne by what we're doing to our environment. And obviously also the U.S. is, you know, basically receding from the world stage on these issues. And this is where you see in the last year and a half the damage that we've done in terms of our reputation as an environmental leader. And again, this is what only happened in the last year and a half in terms of the policy. What will happen in the next 2 years for that?
So let's just quickly go backwards, sure. Which is you have this huge monster storm barreling up the coast. You have the head of the UN leader saying this, you hold the fate of the world in your hands. And then you go to our current administration that is saying, yeah, I think we ought to burn more gas.
Right. Well, you know, the part of that story, the methane story that got me with it, they quote Kathleen Scamma. She's the president of the Western Energy Alliance, which is a group of independent gas and oil companies, et cetera. She praised the Trump administration for turning the oil companies' requests into policy. She noted that during the Obama administration, they would frequently turn proposals from environmental groups into policy. If it all depends on who you trust, and that administration trusted environmentalists, this one trusts the industry.
Yes.
Says it all.
Yes. And by the way, environmentalists could also be code for scientists.
Yes.
But these people, here's the thing about it. These people have no mirrors. I mean, by that, I mean, don't they have to look at the mirror at themselves? Don't they have to look at their grandchildren? Don't they have to think about what they owe to what's coming next in this world? And yet, you know, for a couple of grubby dollars and the rest of it, it seems worth it. Or putting together a coalition, this is really terrible.
Well, it is, and you wonder where with the methane story of just, you know, one of many things that is on the horizon. As I mentioned in the article, I believe I'll just get the wording correct here, but taking their third big, why do I have a picture of King Kong on my screen? There we go. Third big step to roll back fight against climate change. Third major step this year to reverse the U.S.'s previous efforts to rein in global warming. We can only assume there's going to be a fourth and a fifth.
Well, this rule change, I think, is just basically changing that instead of inspecting once every 6 months, you can inspect for leaks once a year. And that if you find a leak, instead of having to fix that leak within 30 days, you have to change it within 60 days. So I think it's an incremental change.
So does that make it better?
Well, I think it's an incremental change from an Obama era policy, and I do look at the United States as a whole since 2007 has dramatically reduced the amount of greenhouse gases going in the air. In 2007, we peaked at about 6,000 metric tons of greenhouse gases, and last year we had 5,000. So the United States, I think,
not because Trump is doing what he's doing.
Well, not because of Trump, but because of states. Because industry itself is regulating itself. And
Obama led the way on this, right?
Absolutely. He deserves a lot of credit for leadership on it. And I also think Americans in general are driving more electric cars. They are very cognizant of the energy that they're using. But while the United States goes down in our emissions, the globe, the world is going up because of these developing countries. And it's hard for a developing country to decide between the environment and development of the country and the economy.
Well, when they see the United States kind of shrugging off these responsibilities, it makes it even easier for a developing country to say, well, if they're not going to do it, why should we do it? And it needs the strength of a world coalition to come in and help these developing countries find a path that isn't as polluting as our path was to our industrial prowess.
I want to also take JP up on the question of incrementalism. You know, These guys are expert at incrementalism. When it comes to a woman's control over her body, you watch the Supreme Court. They're going to incrementalize you to the point where, you know, it's going to be a very difficult thing for any woman to get an abortion. That's what incrementalism means. In this case, incrementalism means that we're going to endanger our kids and our grandchildren to a faulty environment and to rough skies incrementally. It just doesn't wash for me.
Well, when I read that all this does is give them 60 days to clear up a leak and they only have to inspect every 12 months instead of every 6 months, what I wondered was if there are leaks and there is gas getting into the atmosphere, how aggressively will this administration go after them? And that's the question I have. I mean, if they're already letting the industry kind of set the tone, a more laissez-faire approach might mean that they might not even fix them that quickly and see what kind of penalties they get, which might not be that aggressive. I just don't see the Trump administration going after them even after 60 days that aggressively.
Right. And Joe, I know I'm going to be called out of order, you know, on this.
I would never call you out of order.
But when you look...
call you other things, but never out of order.
But when you look at the latest Siena and other polling on the president, and you see this huge indentation, not in the Republican vote. And by the way, 82% of the Republicans are still for Trump, unquestionably. But when you look at the independent votes, and that he's lost huge numbers of independents now, I have to think that they're looking at their children. And they're looking at others in this country and saying, we can't afford to have this country go through this. I think it's not only, you know, the fact that he makes a fool of himself, but I do think that substantively, programmatically, people are into it.
And also it brings into that exactly what you're saying, Alan, about the strength of the Republican Party, of people who would have at one point identified themselves as Republicans who would now be identifying themselves as independents.
Could be. But when they do the polling and they say, are you Republican? And they say, yes, you're at 82% of people who say, I'm with Trump no matter what. And here's the thing, as I have said many times, you know, God has term limits for all of us. And people have to, on some level, be cognizant of the power of money versus, you know, just doing what's right for the general good.
Well, it depends on, obviously, you know, who you're talking to. I think that's still the challenge of trying to connect to the Trump base, is that no matter what you tell them and no matter what would be in their better interest, they will never listen.
And that's a third of the country, Joe.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. Alan has a fistful of letters. We'll get to those in a moment, right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, and Joe Bonilla with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. And Alan has a couple in front of him right now.
I do, Joe. Thanks for the opportunity.
Of course, sir.
Ann says 9/11. As Representative Jim Hines said so well, it's people like Bruce Orr that have kept us safe these last 17 years. And now Trump wants to throw him under the bus? Why? Three guesses and two don't count. No collusion?
Thank you.
Anybody want to comment on that? No. All right. Thank you. And then thanks for helping me out.
Well, I didn't really get it.
Yeah, Bruce Orr. Let's identify who Bruce Orr is.
You know what I've always told my students in journalism and other places? If you are sitting there and somebody says something that you don't know and you don't want to look stupid, you still have to hold up your hand and say, who is this? Because if you don't, you're going to be sitting there, right, Mike, writing that story at 12 o'clock at night and saying, well, I should have raised my hand. Okay. And Bob says, I saw the North Tower on fire from my Brooklyn Heights apartment office. I called my wife to tell her to stay home. Then I gave rides home to some of the people streaming over the Brooklyn Bridge. Later, my wife and I stood in line to give blood at our Park Slope Hospital until a doctor came out to tell us to go home because there were no injured survivors who needed blood. That's not possible, is it?
That was a phenomenon where people were donating blood, but very few people, you know, survived who were seriously injured that needed a blood transfusion. And the people were doing it because they just wanted to do something. Even sure. Here in Albany, they lined up around the building to donate blood because they wanted to do something immediately to help.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And Tom says, thank you for helping me process my yearly sorrow on this day. I was teaching eighth grade at the time. All I knew was that we were
was
under...
Was Joe in your class?
Oh, stop.
Go ahead.
I was 2 years older than that.
I was teaching eighth grade at the time. All I knew was that we were, quote, under attack. I had to teach fourth grade... I had to teach fourth period, wondering whether I and the students still had intact families. Then the principal came on the PA and told the kids what happened. Many of them had family in Manhattan. My own second grade teacher, a nun, cried when the news of JFK's assassination came over the PA. This was my turn to nurse kids through a tough time. We gotta get our act together, and that's from Tom.
It was interesting, actually, going back to that day, is for most of the classes I had, we watched it on television, except for one, my Latin class, and the teacher said, oh, well, you'll just look at it later. It's like, this is history in the making. Mm. This is impactful history that we all should be paying attention
to. It's one of those days which no one will ever forget.
Yeah.
In my case, I'm so much older than everybody, maybe not than Mike, but I remember the day that I remember, I'm older than Mike, don't get me wrong, but the day that JFK died.
Yeah.
Nobody can forget where they were or what
they
were.
This was one of those times. Yeah. I thought Tom's letter was interesting, the way he said, helping me process my annual sorrow. It is. It's an annual sorrow, I think, when we think about where we were and how profoundly hurt and stunned and sad, just so heavily, so much heavy sadness that just prevailed for so long after that. I mean, when I see now, they don't show a lot of the video of the towers getting hit anymore, which I'm glad, because I would get PTSD just seeing
it. Sure.
It's just a really awful time to think back about.
And Jed says, pal, thanks for the 9/11 memorial coverage. How about reminding your listeners about one of the first actions of the Bush administration? Boy, is this right. Which was to fly a plane around our country to escort members of the Saudi royal family safely home. Then we were told to this day, in capital letters, that the terrorists were from Afghanistan. School children are still being taught lies. Your comment.
What's it, 17 or 16 of the, the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi, were Saudi nationals. I mean, so there's a lot of anger and a lot of people who say that it's being covered up. But the plot did get hatched in Afghanistan, I think, is not – I think that has not been disputed. Al-Qaeda was based in Afghanistan, and that's – at least that's the – way I understand it.
But our relationship with Saudi Arabia is really big because we need their oil, and Afghanistan doesn't have the oil that we need. So I read the 9/11 Commission report, which anybody that's interested in history or politics, it is one of the most fascinating reads I've ever had, and it details all of this. And there is certainly a lot of questions to be asked of our government with regards to the relationship with Saudi Arabia, especially with even something like recently with Trump's, quote-unquote Muslim ban leaving off Saudi Arabia. All these other countries are a big danger to us, but not Saudi Arabia, where most of the hijackers came from.
Well, you said a couple of things there that I found interesting, JP, and I'm sure you're right. But when you said we need their oil, We needed their oil. There's no question that at one point we really needed it. Now we're an exporter of our own oil. And the relationship with Saudi Arabia is extraordinarily troubling, at least to me, because they do despicable things around the world, and they're responsible for a lot of bad things, heinous things, and we turn a blind eye towards them. That if the Iranians did and do, we would be all over them for. So it does speak to the kind of self-interest that this country has or perceives to have, or its leadership perceives to have with the Saudis.
Well, it's also, you know, you have this quote-unquote reformer in terms of the younger crown prince and still having this campaign, this PR campaign. So, oh, I'm going to allow women to drive. I'm going to be able to have people go to the movie theater. It's still the same thing. There's definitely some issue that we have to address in terms of what exactly is that relationship.
Well, it's hardly a democratic country, that's for sure.
Right? Yeah.
Roseanne says, "Dear Alan, you mentioned, don't people look in mirrors and care about their grandchildren? I don't know about all the politicians, but looking at Trump, the only person he cares about is himself and Ivanka. He doesn't care about anyone else, even his grandchildren." And that's from Roseanne.
Well, certainly the policies that he's putting together right now don't really denote a really bright future for his grandchildren. That.
You don't think he cares about Donald Jr.? All the reports say he does.
No.
Lee says, part of the solution. I'm an old, proud, perhaps self-righteous recycler of plastics. Recycling is good, but barely scratches the surface of the problem. I have 6 cloth tote bags, Public Radio Pledge Premiums all, some over 10 years old. I was in the Big Y the other day, and I saw a guy with a WMC bag, and I said, good bag. I had my WMC hat on, and he looked at me somewhat puzzled. So 10 years old.
Who is that little guy?
Each holds almost twice as much as a disposable plastic. And over the years, I've done the math. They have kept around 5,000 of the latter out of the trash stream, not to mention the toxic byproducts emitted in their production. A little deeper scratch. Bring your family and friends on board, and you begin to accomplish something. How silly not to accept this simple routine and begin to rescue the earth from the trash heap.
Good letter.
Yeah. Very good letter.
And Richard says, environment, thanks for discussing the effect of the Trump policy. It's been easy to focus on Trump's behavior rather than on the adverse policy changes of his administration. Keep it up. Thank you. Rich Rubin. Oh, Rich. I was not supposed to read his last name. Thank you.
We welcome your letters, WAMC, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to some other topics. Actually, this is one Joe sent that I like a lot. It is because we've been talking about the primaries, talking about the campaigns, and that a lot has been made about political ads, but now viral videos are replacing political ads. Why? Because really nobody's watching television anymore, in the sense that a lot of it's streamed, it's commercial free, and so what's happening is people are passing around these videos that are very either critical or positive toward either your candidate or to another candidate. They are cheaper, and here's the thing that this article points, that they work. They're working. It was one of the things about negative campaign ads on television. How many people actually, do they work? And what kind of negative impact can they have on a candidate? Meaning, if it's about you, or even if you're the person who pulled the trigger on a very horrible ad, does that have an impact on you? So
Joe Bonilla, you're the expert on this. Tell us why you sent out the article.
Well, certainly whenever we advise a campaign, whether it's for direct mail, television, radio, digital media.
And we should point out that's what you do for a living.
Well, it's one of the things we do, right. So one of the ways that we're finding right now in terms of where the demographics are going is that folks better respond to something that looks like it's organically produced, whether it's done on an iPhone or a tablet. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be just something that is done by the candidate because they want to connect directly to those voters. But it's still, you know, it's part of the overall media plan for a campaign. You know, instead of producing these, you know, high quality, glossy television ads that whether for or against the candidate, these pieces really resonate towards somebody's, you know, direct issue basically online, whether it's on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or whatever it could be. And we're finding that basically folks who look at this content will share it on their own, therefore doing our job for us.
Public opinion.
Right. So instead of doing like a $100,000 television buy, we might have to boost it by maybe $100, $200 to be able to reach the same amount of people that we wanted to. So this has a profound impact in terms of the political advertising industry.
The other thing that struck me about the article is, again, that idea that they work, but they also, they're longer. They can be 2-3 minutes and or longer, but they can be a pretty good length. You can tell a story in that time,
right.
and it packs a punch. You're not under the strict limitations of 30 seconds.
Right, and when you look at all the different forms in terms of like that connection, you see with direct mail, maybe 4 to 8 seconds. You know, television, radio, it's 30 seconds, 60 seconds. You're looking at 2 to 5, maybe 10 minute long pieces that people are actually paying attention to. And when you look at the insights, you're seeing they're actually looking at the entire bit of content.
So is this good news for democracy? I think in the short run, my answer would be yes. In the long run, the people with the money will probably figure it out and figure out how to do their own.
They figure it out how to do it. And the thing is, when you look at basically this organic content, all you have to do is be able to sponsor or post it. And Facebook has been doing a better job in terms of identifying who's paying for the content. But even like a year ago, you could pretty much have this organically done piece, and then you would have no idea who was actually paying for it.
But to Alan's point about being good for democracy, how much of this, though, is because of what we know about social media, how much of it is preaching to the choir? In other words, we get an ad for if we happen to look up that we want to buy a new blender, then all of a sudden we have 8,000 ads on our Facebook feed about a new blender. So we can only assume that we are targeted in that sense.
It's absolutely targeted. It's actually based upon behavior in that way.
But it builds the base.
It builds the base. It retains the base.
The other thing, too, I think it's much more difficult to measure. And these polls cannot measure all the impact of these. And that's why they got Ocasio-Cortez's whole primary win over Joe Crowley down in the Bronx and Queens wrong. They just can't measure this.
Well, they also can't measure people in their 30s like Joe and I who have had cell phones our whole lives. We've never had a landline in our own home except when we were kids. So they can't really poll us.
And we've never not had one.
I still got one.
My wife, for instance, still has a number from Connecticut. So they would never find my wife, who is a very likely Democratic primary voter. My question for Joe is on these viral videos, it's very hard to create a viral video, right? I noticed that they have what the candidate is saying typed out on the bottom or on the top, and somehow that makes it much more impactful.
Yes,
have you noticed that?
You absolutely have to do that. You absolutely have to include the subtitle, because let's say you're on the train or a plane or whatever, you can't have that loud.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So you have to include the subtitles, and depending on the audio quality too, you may not be able to hear that person. So that's something you see across the board, not even just for political ads, but really for any sort of online
video.
Yeah,
you even see that on like a Colbert clip.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters and we have more stories to discuss. Alan Chartok is here, Mike Spain, JP Miller, Joe Bonilla. We'll continue our conversation.
Sometimes I wish I was a pain who's not defined by walls or boundaries in his every stroke, there is precision from a man who sees the world for how it is. Sometimes I wish I was a lover.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Just a reminder, the music we're playing in and out of the breaks is from musicians that are playing at Fresh Grass, which is a great bluegrass festival, and it is happening the 14th through the 16th at Mass Mocha. You can find out more by going to massmocha.org. Also, the music playlist is on our website, wamc.org/roundtable, and our friends from Mass Mocha will be coming in right after our panel at 10:30 to talk about the festival and give us a preview as well. So we're excited about that. We have letters. We'll go to those right now, and we'll continue. We have about 20 minutes, and I'm sure we can talk about a lot between now and then.
Thanks, Joe. It's really exciting that, you know, all the people from our region who use WAMC, like the people from Fresh Grass and others, that, you know, come in here and share this stuff with us. It's great. Dear panel, as caring and thoughtful as you all are for the victims of 9/11, it doesn't do justice to their precious lives and those of their suffering family, friends, and country, women and men, to ignore or deny the core reason for the dreadful attack against America's culture of materialism, militarism, and sexual degradation, a culture that is continually imported throughout the world to the demise of the common good. We haven't learned from or self-reflected on this incident. We have, in fact, become even more entrenched in them. Mm. Matt says, Trump attack on a free press. I'm resubmitting a question I posed the panel on January 31st, 2017, but was commented on as unlikely. Here it is again. If Trump gave an order to seize the assets of a major news outlet like the New York Times or ABC News under the guise of national security, what recourse or protection do we have to prevent it? Can protective steps be taken by the governor now to protect the press? Michael.
Well, you know, we'll take any protection we can get.
Yeah.
At this point, whatever you can get.
There are, of course, the courts. And that offers some real protection. The New York Times has a battery of lawyers, and there's none better than them. Even the Times Union has a very good
Where you worry about it is the small media,
exactly.
The small independent media that don't have the deep resources that a lot of larger media companies have, mm-hmm. and those are the ones that are the most vulnerable to the kind of pressure and the threats of lawsuits that could bankrupt a small operation. And that's powerful, and it's intimidating, and there needs to be protections.
Well, not even smaller organizations, but even like the Gawker situation, where it was still significant, you know, amount of money that they have right there, but when you have a suit,
significant money went against
them. Right,
sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy says, 9/11. That morning, I was in my office just outside of Washington, D.C., on the phone with my husband, active duty military assigned to the Pentagon. Yeah. We watched as the smoke rose from the Pentagon. We were afraid. Then I spent hours tracking down all my staff, some in offices, some in coffee shops, some in the Pentagon, some in the Navy Yard, one stuck at Arlington Cemetery metro stop. Then hours later, we learned that three colleagues had been lost while at the Pentagon, briefing government officials about a proposed plan to improve the survivor benefit for military families. Ironic. They were such good people, kind, smart, generous. They were good people. And Jim says, the New York Attorney General primary this Thursday. I'm no political analyst, but isn't it true if Sean Patrick Maloney wins the nomination for New York Attorney General this Thursday, his congressional seat will be up for grabs in a district that voted for Trump by 2 points in the 2016 election? This district is one of only 13 Democratic-held U.S. House districts that Donald Trump won. Maloney won a seat by a similar margin over his Republican opponent, Nan Haworth, back in 2014. There is no announced replacement for him should he drop out of the district race, leaving his opponent, James O'Donnell, possibly sweeping the vote. And that's from Jim in Montgomery. Well, it's an interesting letter. Go ahead.
That's the thing. I mean, Maloney's ahead in the polls. I mean, I think he was down to where Alicia Eve, unfortunately, is in fourth place. And obviously, I think he should go back to running for Congress. But nonetheless, I mean, who will? I haven't heard of any names. Have you?
Well, there's obviously going to be a committee on vacancies that will be.
Yeah.
That committee. So he'll have
right.
a,
yeah.
he by designee, who he puts on his committee to fill vacancies, has pretty much probably knows who they want to pick.
Right.
And,
yeah,
of course, he's going to be in a certain amount of trouble over that, because if the House should go Republican by one vote.
right.
And another question, can he resign and have someone appoint his successor, or would it be?
No, a House of Representatives seat is a special election. Yeah. If it was a Senate seat, the governor could appoint somebody. But a House of Representatives seat does not get appointed. It's established by a special election that the governor could call.
Right. Sooner or later, and that always becomes the question.
Mm-hmm.
That's from Jim in Montgomery. Good letter. And George says, panel, why not cover the story about the Cuomo administration telling the contractor constructing the new Tappan Zee Bridge to speed up construction so he could have a press event for his own self-promotion? Well, you know he's making a good deal about that. Do you know the answer to that?
Yeah.
The attorney, I'll give you a hint, an attorney general candidate. This teach out. She said she wants.
Both Joe Bonilla and I happened to travel downstate on Saturday expecting to be driving over the newly opened eastbound span of the what was formerly the Tappan Zee Bridge, now
and
the Mary O. M. Cuomo Bridge. And we were unable to do so.
I was right on that section in Rockland County. I was telling friends of mine, oh, yeah, there's a new span. And then you get down the hill, I'm like, oh.
Where is it?
It's the same
one. It's over there.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
It's like Wally World being closed.
it was about the same.
Yeah.
No kidding. I mean, I went that way.
I was excited. I was excited to do it. It's like,
Well, I think what's interesting about that story is a little bit the media coverage, whereas Governor Cuomo had a big opening celebration with his family and with former Secretary Hillary Clinton, and the media didn't make it that big of a story. The media, I think, kind of saw it as a little bit of a campaign event disguised as a taxpayer event. But now the blowback from the shutdown has turned into a much bigger media story, and it's one of those where how could the governor ever anticipate that happening? And it seems to me like a little bit a little bit of bad luck and
certainly backfired. Yes. Which, and he was driving the Packard across the bridge.
The 32 Packard.
Yeah, that was the one that used to be on the top floor of the State Museum, but has now been made road ready, and it's used to open roads.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
All right, we're ready to move on? No, we're done? Okay.
Don't look at me.
Oh, no, Mike pointed to you. I thought you had something to say.
Oh, I cut him off.
Oh, I see.
I wanted to.
All right, so let's talk about the PLO office closure, the Trump administration ordering the closure of PLO office in Washington. Here's the story. The Trump administration on Monday ordered the closure of the Palestine Liberation Organization office in Washington, saying that the PLO, quote, has not taken steps to advance the start of direct and meaningful negotiations with Israel. The closure was announced by the State Department shortly after White House National Security Advisor John Bolton, in his first major policy speech, threatened U.S. punishment for individuals in countries that cooperate with the International Criminal Court, where the Palestinians have lodged complaints against Israel. The U.S. supports a direct and robust peace process, Bolton said, and we will not allow the ICC or any other organization to contain Israel's right to self-defense. Who would like to weigh in first?
Apparently no one.
Well, it's a tough topic. You know. I mean, you certainly want to see the U.S. government put pressure on the PLO to engage in peace talks. Is this the right tactic? I feel like it is not. I mean, certainly there's much to be much criticism can be levied on the PLO. But, today it was in the news that Trump may want to have a second summit with Kim Jong-un. This is a guy who's building nuclear bombs and aiming them at the United States. And in the end, as much as, you know, Trump shouldn't be cozying up to him and praising him, I think I'm very uncomfortable with that. Wouldn't you rather have us talking to our adversaries rather than, rallying them against us? And this is the impact. This will rally the Middle East, the non-Israel Middle East, against the United States, which I don't think is useful in the United States' role to try to broker peace there.
You really can't. You really can't run a government by polling. You poll in this country and you say, do you like Israel? Yes. Do you like the PLO? No. No. And therefore, close them down. It's another part of the politics of distraction, which this guy is, this president is a master at. You know, you move an embassy, you close down, you have targeted groups that are part of your constituency, and you do what you can to have them. Now, I'm Jewish and I'm not part of the group, but I got to tell you, these guys are going according to what they see in the polls.
Well, it's part of this, again, this coordinated chaos set of diplomacy that the Trump administration has been pushing forward since January 20th of last year. And the problem is that, you know, we're talking about this right now, but we're looking at the long-range impact that it means to our allies, the folks here in this country, but also trying to ultimately look at what that, you know, meaningful peace process looks like in the Middle East.
Yeah. Let me read a letter, Joe, that we just came in, thanks to Sarah. Trump and 9/11. President Trump shows what a gutless coward he really is by not visiting the site of the World Trade Center attack, but going to Pennsylvania in the middle of a field where there are no unorchestrated crowds to voice their opposition to his corrupt presidency.
Yeah, I'm not going to go there.
I think that's unfair. Yeah. I mean, there's a brand new memorial that was built in Pennsylvania. This is the first year that 9/11 that they've had a memorial at that site in Shanksville, and I think that's a fine place to go and memorialize those who lost.
And yet, no, I agree with you. And yet, there is a point to be made that this guy can't show his face in New York City, because if he does, there's going to be hell to pay.
Well, I think members of the White House staff are hoping that he stays on his talking points today in Shanksville. Mm-hmm. You know, he has talked in the past of where what he was doing on 9/11, and I think he, you know, he has talked, I think, with...
About New Jersey.
Yeah, take it...
Yes. So,
take it slowly, JP,
so,
go ahead.
So I think that the White House is hoping he stays on his talking points and doesn't veer off them. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I think they all want that to happen, and it's unlikely that he would go off.
See Mike right there. Mm-hmm. We all think it's unlikely. Right?
You're giving him a lot of credit.
Yeah.
Of course, you're not privy to all of the news that he's getting by his lawyers and others about what's going on in his life at on that moment or that day. And that, I think, is probably why he goes a little nutty in some of these off-script remarks.
This is an opportunity for the commander-in-chief, the president, to unite the country in on something that we all come together on. And to miss this opportunity and politicize it would be a grotesque error, I think. It would backfire on him, and it would be sad.
Well, probably, you know, if anything, to hedge bets, probably he'll probably make some, you know, attack on President Obama. President Bush, which he had, you know, basically given that President Obama is now back in the limelight, basically rallying Democrats for the midterms, I would expect possibly that he might make some, you know, sort of jab toward former President Obama.
We haven't talked about that yet. What have you made of the re-emergence of the 44th President of the United States?
There are those who say that that is going to, you know, embolden the Trump base and that they'll come out because Obama has come out, to which I say nonsense. You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that the guy is sucking all of the wind out of the news, and where's the other side? And then when you get the other side, you see that 33%, which we've been talking about before, or 30% now or something like that, gets to make the decision about their potential for turning out. No, I think Obama, who won the presidency, let's face it, partially because of identity politics, is going to bring out a lot of people who would not get out otherwise.
Well, he has not been successful at bringing out turnout for other people other than himself. He was very successful in 2008 and again in 2012. Less successful, but successful. But as far as rallying people for other candidates, it doesn't seem like he's been that successful. Maybe he will this time.
I was going to say, as to quote the inestimable Alphonse D'Amato, that was then and this is now. Things have changed substantially since then.
I look at the party, and I think Democrats have to be super excited that Barack Obama is going to come out and campaign for them and be active. You look at who are the other alternatives? Bill Clinton, they're not rolling him out. They're not rolling out Hillary Clinton. They're not rolling out Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Barack Obama can give a very forceful, cohesive, positive message for Democrats in opposing Donald Trump. I think he can do it better than any other Democrat in the country.
Well, I agree with
Joe
you.
Joe Biden does it pretty well.
But speaking of which, I wonder if anybody else besides me was listening to NPR this morning and heard the incredible interview with Ken Starr sort of apologizing for his role in the Bill Clinton impeachment.
Do you think he was apologizing?
Well, no, he was saying he shouldn't have been impeached. He should have been, which he led to.
Yeah. I thought he came off as really smarmy, didn't you?
Absolutely. That's my point.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely awful. Remember, this is a guy who's now been fired.
Because
he has a university presidency and all the rest.
Did they do an interview today, too?
What they did is they had an interview yesterday, which was on his book.
Right.
And then they sat him down at a microphone and had a further conversation, and that's what they played this morning.
So I didn't hear the one this morning. I heard the one yesterday, but I was struck by he was making this case about the lying and the power of those lies, and yet was making excuses for the current president, and that was something I couldn't justify. I don't know. I had trouble with that. But anybody else?
It's just that when Ken Starr had so much resource. I mean, he had millions and millions and millions of dollars in order to get, to get Clinton on lying about an affair or a sexual, abuse or assault relationship that was not during his presidency. That compared to what's going on now, it's just unbelievable that you would even equivocate, try to make the two equal.
Right. Yeah. We are out of time. My thanks to our wonderful group this morning, Joe Bonilla, J.P. Miller, Mike Spain, and Alan Chartok. We will be back after this break.